The 33 sermons on Nibbana were delivered by the Venerable Bhikkhu Katukurunde Nyanananda in Sinhala at Mitrigala Nisaranavanaya Forest Hermitage. They were translated into English by the same Venerable Monk, presently residing at Potkulkala Forest Hermitage in Kandigedra Devalagam.
Nibbana Sermon Number 7, Translation. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Etaṃ santaṃ etaṃ paṇītaṃ yadidaṃ sabba saṅkhāra samatho sabbūpadhi paṭi nissaggo taṇhakkhayo virāgo nirodho nibbānaṃ. This is peaceful, this is excellent, namely the stilling of all preparations, the relinquishment of all assets, the destruction of craving, detachment, cessation, extinction. With the permission of the most venerable great preceptor and the assembly of the venerable meditative monks, towards the end of the last sermon, we happen to quote a certain verse from the Kevaddha Sutta of the Digha Nikaya. The verse runs as follows. Vinyanam anidassanam anantam sabbato pabham ittha apocha pathavi tejo vayo nagadhati ittha dighancha rasancha anunthulam subhasubham ittha namancha rupancha asesam uparujyati vinyanasya nirodhena itthetam uparujyati. The other day we could give only a general idea of the meaning of this verse in brief because of the question of time. Today we propose to attempt a detailed explanation of it. To start with, we purposely avoid rendering the first two lines which appear as the crux of the whole verse. Taking those two lines as they are, we could paraphrase the verse as follows. It is in a conscious, that is anidassana, ananta and sabbato pabha, that earth, water, fire and air do not find a footing. It is in this consciousness that long and short, fine and coarse, and present and unpresent, as well as name and form, are kept in check. It is by the cessation of consciousness that all these are held in check. Let us now try to sort out the meaning of the difficult words in the first two lines. First of all, in the expression vinyanam anidassanam, there is the term anidassanam. The meaning of the word nidassana is fairly well known. It means illustration. Something that throws light on or makes clear is called nidassana. This is the basic sense. We find an instance of the use of this word, even in this basic sense, in the first causal sutta among the tenets of the Anguttara Nikaya. It is in connection with the description of abhibhayatana, basis of mastery, where there is a reference to contemplation devices known as kasina. It is said that even the flax flower can be used initially as a sign for kasina meditation. The flax flower is described in the following words. Umma puppang neelang neelavannang neelanidassanang neelanibhasan, which may be rendered as the flax flower blue, blue colored, manifesting blue, shining blue. Neelanidassanang suggests that the flax flower is an illustration of blue color, or that it is a manifestation of blue. Anidassana could therefore be said to refer to whatever that does not manifest anything. In fact, we have a very good example in support of this suggested sense in the Kakachupama Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya. There we find the Buddha putting a certain question to the monks in order to bring out a simile. Monks, suppose a man comes with crimson, turmeric, indigo or carmine and says, I shall draw pictures and make pictures appear on this kite. What do you think, monks, could that man draw pictures and make pictures appear there? Then the monks reply, Ayanghi bhante akaso arupi anidassano tattha nasukarang rupang likhitum rupapatu bhavang katum. This sky, Lord, is immaterial and non-illustrative. It is not easy to draw a picture there or make manifest pictures there. Here we have the words in support of the above suggested meaning. The sky is said to be arupi anidassano, immaterial and non-illustrative. That is why one cannot draw pictures there or make pictures appear there. There is nothing material in the sky to make manifest pictures. That is the sense in which it is called anidassano in this context. Let us now see how meaningful that word is when used with reference to consciousness as vijnanam anidassana. Why the sky is said to be non-manifestative, we could easily understand by the simile. But how can consciousness become non-manifestative? First and foremost, we can remind ourselves of the fact that our consciousness has in it the ability to reflect. That ability is called paccavekkhana, looking back. Sometimes the Buddha has given the simile of the mirror with reference to this ability, as for instance in the Ambalattika Rāhulavāda Sutta of the Majjhima Nikāya. In the Ānanda Sutta of the Khanda Saṅyutta also, he has used the simile of the mirror. In the former sutta preached to Venerable Rāhula, the Buddha uses the simile of the mirror to stress the importance of reflection in regard to bodily, verbal and mental action. In our last sermon, we gave a simile of a dog crossing a plank over a stream and looking at its own reflection in the water. That too is a kind of reflection. But from that we can deduce a certain principle with regard to the question of reflection, namely that the word stands for a mode of becoming deluded as well as a mode of getting rid of the delusion. What creates a delusion is the way that dog is repeatedly looking down from his wrong point of view on the plank to see a dog in the water. That is unwise reflection born of non-radical attention, ayoniso manasikara. Under the influence of the personality view, sakkaya ditthi, it goes on looking at its own image, wagging its tail and growling. But wise reflection born of radical attention, yoniso manasikara, is what is recommended in the Ambalattika Rāhulavāda Sutta with its thematic repetitive phrase paccavekkhitvā paccavekkhitvā, reflecting again and again. Wise reflection inculcates the Dhamma point of view. Reflection based on right view, sammāditthi, leads to deliverance. So this is the twin aspect of reflection. But this we mention by the way. The point we wish to stress is that consciousness has in it the nature of reflecting something like a mirror. Now vijñānam anidassanam is a reference to the nature of the released consciousness of an arahant. It does not reflect anything. To be more precise, it does not reflect a nāma rūpa or name and form. An ordinary individual sees a nāma rūpa when he reflects, which he calls I and mine. It is like the reflection of that dog which sees its own delusive reflection in the water. A non-arahant upon reflection sees name and form, which however he mistakes to be his self. With the notion of I and mine, he falls into delusion with regard to it. But the arahant's consciousness is an unestablished consciousness. We have already mentioned in previous sermons about the established consciousness and the unestablished consciousness. A non-arahant's consciousness is established on name and form. The unestablished consciousness is that which is free from name and form and is unestablished on name and form. The established consciousness upon reflection reflects name and form on which it is established, whereas the unestablished consciousness does not find a name and form as a reality. The arahant has no attachments or entanglements in regard to name and form. In short, it is a sort of penetration of name and form without getting entangled in it. This is how we have to unravel the meaning of the expression anidassana vijnana. By way of further clarification of this sense of anidassana, we may remind ourselves of the fact that manifestation requires something material. That is obvious even from that simile picked up at random from the Kakachupama Sutta. As for the consciousness of the arahant, the verse in question makes it clear that earth, water, fire and air do not find a footing there. It is because of these four great primaries that one gets the perception of form. They are said to be the cause and condition for the designation of the aggregate of form. Chattaro kho bhikkhu mahabhuta hetu chattaro mahabhuta paccayo rupakkhandassa panyapanaya. The four great primaries, monk, are the cause and condition for the designation of the form group. Now the Arahant has freed his mind from these four elements. As it is said in the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, Patavidhatuya Chittang Virajeti. He makes his mind dispassionate with regard to the earth element. Apodhatuya Chittang Virajeti. He makes his mind dispassionate with regard to the water element. As he has freed his mind from the four elements through disenchantment which makes them fade away, the Arahant's reflection does not engender a perception of form. As the verse in question puts it rather rhetorically, Yatha apocha pathavi tejo vayo na gadhati, wherein water and earth, fire and air, find no footing. Here the word gadhati is particularly significant. When, for instance, we want to plumb the depth of a deep well, we lower something material as a plumb into the well. Where it comes to stay, we take as the bottom. In the consciousness of the Arahant, the material elements cannot find such a footing. They cannot manifest themselves in the unplumbed depths of the Arahant's consciousness. Vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato pabham itha apocha pathavi tejo vayo na gadhati. Consciousness which is non-manifestative, endless and lustrous on all sides, it is here that water, earth, fire and air no footing find. It is precisely because the material elements cannot make themselves manifest in it that this consciousness is called non-manifestative. In the same connection, we may add that such distinctions as long and short, fine and coarse, and present and unpresent are not registered in that consciousness because they pertain to things material. When the consciousness is freed from the four elements, it is also free from the relative distinctions which are but the standards of measurements proper to those elements. Let us now consider the implications of the term anantam, endless, infinite. We have already said something about the plumbing of the depths of waters. Since the material elements have faded away in that consciousness, they are unable to plumb its depth. They no longer serve as an index to that consciousness. Therefore, that consciousness is endless or infinite. It is endless also in another sense. With regard to such distinctions as long and short, we use the word relative. These are relative concepts. We even refer to them as conjoined pairs of terms. In worldly usage, they are found conjoined as long and short, fine and coarse, pleasant and unpleasant. There is a dichotomy about these concepts. There is a bifurcation. It is as if they are put within a rigid framework. When, for instance, we go searching for a piece of wood for some purpose or other, we may say, this piece of wood is too long. Why do we say so? Because we are in need of a shorter one. Instead of saying that it is not sufficiently short, we say it is too long. When we say it is too short, what we mean is that it is not sufficiently long. So then, long and short are relevant within one framework. As a matter of fact, all measurements are relative to some scale or other. They are meaningful within some framework of a scale. In this sense too, the worldling's way of thinking has a tendency to go to extremes. It goes to one extreme or the other. When it was said that the world for the most part rests on a dichotomy, such as that between the two waves is and is not, this idea of a framework is already implicit. The worldling's ways of thought end up in one extreme or the other within this framework. The Arahant transcends it. His consciousness is therefore endless, ananta. There is a verse in the Patiligami Yavagga of the Udana which clearly brings out this fact. Most of the discourses in that section of the Udana deal with Nibbana, Nibbana Patisamyutta. And the following verse too is found in such a discourse. Duddhasam anantam nama nahi satyam sudassana patividdha tanna janato vasato natthi kinchana. This verse, like many other deep ones, seems to have puzzled the commentators. Let alone the meaning, even the variant readings had posed them a problem, so much so that they end up giving the reader a choice between alternate interpretations. But let us try to get at the general trend of its meaning. Duddhasam anantam nama. hard to see is the endless, whatever that endless be. Nahi satchang sudassana, the truth is not easily seen, which in effect is an emphatic assertion of the same idea. One could easily guess that this endless is the truth and that it refers to Nibbana. Patividdha tanha means that craving has been penetrated through. This penetration is through knowledge and wisdom, the outcome of which is stated in the last line, Jānato pasato nathi kinchana. To one who knows and sees, there is nothing. The idea is that when craving is penetrated through with knowledge and wisdom, one realizes the voidness of the world. Obviously, the reference here is to Nibbana. The entire verse may now be rendered as follows. Hard to see is the endless, not easy it is to see the truth. Pierced through is craving, and not for him who knows and sees. The commentator, however, is at a loss to determine whether the correct reading is anattam or anantam, and leaves the question open. He gives one interpretation in favor of the reading anattam. To show its justifiability, he says that natha is a synonym for tanha or craving, and that anattam is a term for nibbana in the sense that there is no craving in it. It must be pointed out that it is nati and not natha that is used as a synonym for tanha. Anyway, after adducing reasons for the acceptability of the reading anattam, he goes on to say that there is a variant reading anantam and gives an interpretation in support of it too. In fact, he interprets the word anantam in more than one sense. Firstly, because Nibbana is permanent, it has no end. And secondly, it is endless because it is immeasurable or appamana. In our interpretation of the word anantam, we have not taken it in the sense of permanence or everlastingness. The word appamana or immeasurable can have various nuances, but the one we have stressed is the transcendence of relative concepts limited by their dichotomous nature. We have also alluded to the unplumbed depth of the Arahant's consciousness in which the four elements do not find a footing. In the Buddha Vagga of the Dhammapada, we come across another verse which highlights the extraordinary significance of the word anantam. Yasa jalini visattika tanha nathi kuhinchi netave tang buddha mananta gocharang apadang kena padena nesata. Before attempting a translation of this verse, some of the words in it have to be commented upon. Yasa jalini visattika. Jalini is a synonym for craving. It means one who has a net or one who goes netting. Visattika refers to the agglutinative character of craving. It keeps worldlings glued to objects of sense. The verse may be rendered as follows. He who has no craving, which nets seeing and agglutinates to lead him somewhere, by what track could that awakened one of infinite range be led, trackless as he is? Because the Buddha is of infinite range, he is trackless, his path cannot be traced. Craving wields the net of name and form with its clue when it goes ranging. But since the awakened one has the endless as his range, there is no track to trace him by. The term Ananta Gocharang means one whose range has no end or limit. If, for instance, one chases a deer to catch it, one might succeed at least at the end of the pasture. But the Buddha's range is endless, and his ranging leaves no track. The commentators seem to interpret this term as a reference to the Buddha's omniscience, to his ability to attend to an infinite number of objects. But this is not the sense in which we interpret the term here. The very fact that there is no object makes the Buddha's range endless and untraceable. Had there been an object, craving could have netted him in. In support of this interpretation, we may allude to the following couple of verses in the Arahanta Vagga of the Dhammapada. Ye sang sannichayo nathi ye parinyata bhojana sunyato animitto cha vimukho yesa gocharo akaseva sakuntanam gati tesam durannaya yassasava parikhina ahareche anisito sunyato animitto cha vimukho yesa gocharo akaseva sakuntanam padam tassa durannaya. Both verses express more or less the same idea. Let us examine the meaning of the first verse. The first two lines are, Yesang sannicheyo natthi ye parinyati bhojana. Those who have no accumulation and who have comprehended their food. The words used here are charged with deep meanings. Verses in the Dhammapada are very often Krichini Mejari. The Buddha has on many occasions presented the Dhamma through deep similes and metaphors. If the metaphorical sense of a term is ignored, one can easily miss the point. For instance, the word Sannicheya in this context, which we have rendered as accumulation, is suggestive of the heaping up of the five aggregates. The word Upacheya is sometimes used with reference to this process of heaping up that goes on in the minds of the worldly. Now this heaping up as well as the accumulation of karma is not there in the case of an arahant. Also, they have comprehended their food. The comprehension of food does not mean simply the usual reflection on food in terms of elements, nor does it imply just one kind of food, but all the four nutriments mentioned in the Dhamma, namely kabalinkara ahara, material food, phassa, contact, mano sanchetana, volition, and vijnana, consciousness. The next two lines tell us what the true range of or pasture of the arahants is. It is an echo of the idea of comprehension of food as well as the absence of accumulation. Sunyato animitto cha vimokho yesa gocharo. Whose range is the deliverance of the void and the signless. When the arahants are in their attainment to the fruit of arahanthood, their minds turn towards the void and the signless. When they are on this feeding ground, neither mara nor craving can catch them with their nets. They are trackless. Hence the last two lines, Akaseva sakuntanam gati tesam durannaya. Their track is hard to trace, like that of birds in the sky. The word gati in this last line is interpreted by the commentators as a reference to the whereabouts of the arahants after their parinibbana. It has dubious associations of some place as a destination. But in this context, gati does not lend itself to such an interpretation. It only refers to their mental compass, which is untraceable because of their deliverance through the void and the signless. The next verse also brings out this idea. Yassasava parikhena aharecha anisito, whose influxes are extinct and who is unattached in regard to nutriment. Sunyato animittocha vimokho yassa gocharo, whose range is the void and the signless. Akaseva sakuntanam padang tasa durannayam, his path is hard to trace like that of birds in the sky. This reminds us of the last line of the verse quoted earlier. Apadang kena padena nissat, by what track could one lead him who is trackless? These two verses then throw more light on the meaning of the expression ananta gochara, of infinite range, used as an epithet for the awakened one. Let us now get at the meaning of the term sabbatopabha. In the context vijnana anidassanam anantam sabbatopabha. In our discussion of the significance of the drama and the cinema, we mentioned that it is the darkness in the background which keeps the audience entranced in a way that they identify themselves with the characters and react accordingly. The darkness in the background throws a spell of delusion. That is what makes for enjoyment. Of course, there is some sort of light in the cinema hall, but that is very limited. Sometimes it is only a beam of light directed on the screen. In a previous sermon, we happened to mention that even in the case of a matinee show, dark curtains and closed doors and windows ensure the necessary dark background. Here, in this simile, we have a clue to the meaning of sabbatopabham, luminous or lustrous on all sides. Suppose a matinee show is going on and one is enjoying it entranced and deluded by it. Suddenly, doors and windows are flung open and the dark curtains are removed. Then immediately one slips out of the cinema world. The film may go on, but because of the light coming from all sides, the limited illumination on the screen fades away before the total illumination. The film thereby loses its enjoyable quality. as far as consciousness or vijnana is concerned, it is not something completely different from wisdom, paññā, as it is defined in the Mahavedala Sutta. However, there is also a difference between them. Paññā bhāvetabbā vijñānaṁ pariññayyaṁ. Wisdom is to be developed, consciousness is to be comprehended. Here it is said that one has to comprehend the nature of consciousness. Then one may ask, we are understanding everything with consciousness. So how can one understand consciousness? But the Buddha has shown us the way of doing it. Wisdom, when it is developed, enables one to comprehend consciousness. In short, consciousness is as narrow as that beam of light falling on the cinema screen. That is to say, the specifically prepared consciousness, or the consciousness crammed up in name and form, as in the case of the non-arahant. It is as narrow as the perspective of the audience glued to the screen. The consciousness of the ordinary worldling is likewise limited and committed. Now what happens when it is fully illuminated on all sides with wisdom? It becomes sabbato pabhang, lustrous on all sides. In that luster which comes from all sides, the framework of ignorance fades away. It is that released consciousness, free from the dark framework of ignorance, that is called the consciousness which is lustrous on all sides in that cryptic verse in question. This luster associated with wisdom has a special significance according to the discourses. In the Chatukka Nipata of the Anguttara Nikaya, we come across the following sutta. Chatasso ima bhikkhave pabha, katama chatasso chandapabha, suryapabha, aggipabha, panyapabha. Ima kho bhikkhave chatasso pabha, etadaggam bhikkhave imasang chatasannang pabhanang, yadidang panyapabha. Monks, there are these four lusters. Which four? The luster of the moon, the luster of the sun, the luster of the fire, and the luster of wisdom. These monks are the four lusters. This monk is the highest among these four lusters, namely the luster of wisdom. Another important discourse, quoted quite often, though not always correctly interpreted, is the following. Pabhasara midang bhikkave chittang, panchakho agantukehi upapilesehi upapilittang. Tang asutava puthujjano yathabhutang nappajanati. Tasma asutavato puthujjanasa chittabhavana nathiti vadami. Pabhasara midam bhikkave chittang, tanchakho agantukehi upakkilesehi vipamuttang. Tang sutava aryasavako yathabhutang pajanati. Tasma sutavato aryasavakasya chittabhavana athiti vadami. This mind, monks, is luminous, but it is defiled by extraneous defilements that the uninstructed ordinary man does not understand as it is. Therefore, there is no mind development for the ordinary man, I declare. This mind, monks, is luminous, but it is released from extraneous defilements that the instructed noble disciple understands as it is. Therefore, there is mind development for the instructed noble disciple, I declare. It is sufficiently clear then that the allusion is to the luminous mind, the consciousness of the Arahant, which is non-manifestative, infinite, and all lustrous. To revert to the analogy of the cinema, which at least in a limited sense helps us to form an idea about it, we have spoken about the stilling of all preparations. Now in the case of the film too, there is a stilling of preparations. That is to say, the preparations which go to make it a movie film are stilled. The multicolored dress of actors and actresses become colorless before that illumination, even in the case of a technicolor film. The scenes on the screen get blurred before the light that suddenly envelops them. And what is the outcome of it? The preparations going on in the minds of the audience, whether induced by the film producers or aroused from within, are calmed down at least temporarily. This symbolizes, in a limited sense, the significance of the phrase sabba sankhara samatha, the stilling of all preparations. Then what about the relinquishment of all assets? Sabbopadhi patinissagga. In the context of the film show, it is the bundle of experiences coming out of one's vested interests in the marvelous cinema world. These assets are relinquished at least for the moment. destruction of craving, tanha khayo, is momentarily experienced with regard to the blurred scenes on the screen. As to the term viraga, we have already shown that it can be understood in two senses, that is, dispassion as well as the fading away which brings about the dispassion. Now in this case too, the fading away occurred not by any other means, but by the very fact that the limited narrow beam of consciousness got superseded by the unlimited light of wisdom. Nirodha means cessation, and the film has now ceased to be a film, though the machines are still active. We have already mentioned that in the last analysis, a film is produced by the audience. So its cessation too is a matter for the audience. This then is the cessation of the film. Now comes Nibbana, extinction or extinguishment. Whatever heated emotions and delirious excitements that arose out of the film show cool down, at least momentarily, when the illumination takes over. This way, we can form some idea, somewhat inferentially, about the meaning and significance of the term sabbatopabham, with the help of this illustration based on the film show. So now we have tackled most of the difficulties to the interpretation of this verse. In fact, it is the few words occurring in the first two lines that has posed an insoluble problem to scholars both Eastern and Western. We haven't yet given the commentarial interpretation, and that not out of disrespect for the venerable commentators. It is because their interpretation is rather hazy and inconclusive. However, we shall be presenting that interpretation at the end of this discussion so as to give the reader an opportunity to compare it with ours. But for the present, let us proceed to say something about the last two lines as well. Vijnanasa nirodhena itthetam uparujyati. As we saw above, for all practical purposes, name and form seem to cease, even like the fading away of the scenes on the cinema screen. Then what is meant by this phrase, vijnanasa nirodhena, with the cessation of consciousness? The reference here is to that abhisankhata vijnana, or the specifically prepared consciousness. It is the cessation of that concocted type of consciousness which was formerly there, like the one directed on the cinema screen by the audience. With the cessation of that specifically prepared consciousness, all constituents of name and form are said to be held in check, uparujyati. Here too we have a little problem. Generally, nirujyati and uparujyati are regarded as synonymous. The way these two verbs are used in some suttas would even suggest that they mean the same thing. As a matter of fact, even the Mahanidesa, which is a very old commentary, paraphrases uparujyati by nirujyati. Uparujyati iti nirujyati. Nevertheless, in the context of this particular verse, there seems to be something deep involved in the distinction between these two verbs. Even at a glance, the two lines in question are suggestive of some distinction between them. Vijnanasa nirodhena itthetam uparujyati. The nirodha of consciousness is said to result in the uparodha of whatever constitutes name and form. This is intriguing enough, but that is not all. By way of preparing the background for the discussion, we have already made a brief allusion to the circumstances in which the Buddha uttered this verse. What provided the context for its utterance was a riddle that occurred to a certain monk in a moment of fancy. The riddle was, where do these four great primaries cease altogether? There the verb used is nirujjanti. So in order to find where they ceased, he whimsically went from heaven to heaven and from Brahma world to Brahma world. As we mentioned earlier too, it was when the Mahabrahma directed that monk to the Buddha, saying, why on earth did you come all this way when the Buddha is there to ask? That the Buddha reworded the question. He pointed out that the question was incorrectly worded and revised it as follows before venturing to answer it. Katha apocha pathavi tejo vayo nagadhati katha dighancha rasancha anunthulang subha subham katha namancha rupancha asesang uparujyati. The verb used by the Buddha in this revised version is uparujyati and not nirujyati. Yet another innovation is the use of the term Nagadhati. Where do water, earth, fire and air find no footing, or where do they not get established? In short, here is a verb suggestive of plumbing the depths of a reservoir. We may hark back to the simile given earlier concerning the plumbing of the consciousness with the perception of form. Where do the four elements not find a footing? Also, where are such relative distinctions as long and short, subtle and gross, present and present, as well as name and form, are completely held in check? In this restatement of the riddle, the Buddha has purposely avoided the use of the verb niruddhati. Instead, he had recourse to such terms as nagadhati, does not find a footing, does not plumb, and uparuddhati, is held in check or is cut off. This is evidence enough to infer that there is a subtle distinction between the nuances associated with the two verbs niruddhati and uparuddhati. What is the secret behind this peculiar usage? The problem that occurred to this monk is actually of the type that the materialists of today conceive of. It is in itself a fallacy to say that the four elements cease somewhere in the world or in the universe is a contradiction in terms. Why? Because the very question, where do they cease, presupposes an answer in terms of those elements by way of defining that place. This is the kind of uncouth question an ordinary materialistically inclined person would ask. That is why the Buddha reformulated the question, saying, "Monk, that is not the way to put the question. You should not ask where the four great primaries cease, but rather where they, as well as the concepts of long and short, subtle and gross, pleasant and unpleasant, and name and form, are held in check. The question proper is not where the four great primaries cease, but where they do not get established, and where all their accompaniments are held in check." Here then we see the Buddha relating the concept of matter, which the world takes for granted, to the perception of form arising in the mind. The four great primaries haunt the minds of the worldlings like ghosts, so they have to be exorcised from their minds. It is not a question of expelling them from this world or from any heavenly realm or the entire world system. That exorcism should take place in this very consciousness so as to put an end to this haunting. Before the light of wisdom, those ghosts, namely the four great primaries, become ineffective. It is in the darkness of ignorance that these ghosts haunt the worldlings with the perception of form. They keep the minds of the worldlings bound, glued, committed and limited. What happens now is that the specifically prepared consciousness, which was bound, glued, committed and limited, becomes fully released due to the light of wisdom to become non-manifestative, endless and lustrous on all sides. So, to sum up, we may render the verse in question as follows. Consciousness which is non-manifestative, endless, lustrous on all sides, here it is that earth and water, fire and air, no footing find, here it is that long and short, fine and coarse, pleasant, unpleasant, and name and form are cut off without exception. When consciousness has ceased, these are held in check herein. Though we venture to translate the verse, we haven't yet given the commentarial interpretation of it. Since this might seem a shortcoming, we shall now present what the commentator has to say on this verse. Venerable Buddha Gosa, before coming to this verse in his commentary to the Kevaddha Sutta, gives an explanation as to why the Buddha reformulated the original question of that monk. According to him, the question, where do the four great primaries cease, implied both the organic and the inorganic aspects of matter, and in revising it, the Buddha limited its scope to the organic. In other words, Venerable Buddha Gosa presumes that the revised version has to be interpreted with reference to this human body. Hence he explains such words as long and short occurring in the verse in a limited sense as referring to the body's stature. How facile this interpretation turns out to be, one can easily discern as we go on. Venerable Buddha Gosa keeps on reminding the reader that the questions are relevant only to the organic realm. Upadinnangiva sandhaya puccha. So he interprets the terms dighamcha rasamcha, long and short, as relative distinctions of a person's height, that is tallness and shortness. Similarly, the words anum thulam, subtle and gross, are said to mean the small and big in the size of the body. Likewise, subha and asubha are taken to refer to the comely and the ugly in terms of body's appearance. The explanation given to the phrase namancha rupancha is the most astounding of all. Nama is said to be the name of the person and rupa is his form or shape. All this goes to show that the commentator has gone off at a tangent, even in the interpretation of this verse, which is more or less the prologue to such an intricate verse as the one in question. He has blundered at the very outset in limiting the scope of those relative terms to the organic, thereby obscuring the meaning of that deep verse. The significance of these relative terms, from the linguistic point of view, has been overlooked. Words like dighang, rasang and anunthulang do not refer to the stature and size of some person. What they convey is the dichotomous nature of concepts in the world. All those deeper implications are obscured by the reference to a person's outward appearance. The confusion becomes worst confounded when namancha rupancha is interpreted as the name and the shape of a person. So the stage is already set for a shallow interpretation even before presenting the verse beginning with vijnanam anidarsanam. It is on such an unsound premise that the commentator bases his interpretation of the verse in question. We shall try to do justice to that exposition too. It might necessitate a fair amount of quotations, though it is difficult to be comprehensive in this respect. The commentator begins his exposition with the word vijnanam itself. He comes out with a peculiar etymology. Vijnananti tathe vijnatabbanti vijnanam nibbanasya namam, which means that the word vijnana or consciousness is in this context a synonym for nibbana, in the sense that it is to be known, vijnatabbam. This forced etymology is far from convincing, since such a usage is not attested elsewhere. Moreover, we come across a long list of epithets for nibbana, as many as 33 in Asankhata Sanyutta of the Sanyutta Nikaya, but vijnana is not counted as one. In fact, nowhere in the discourses is vijnana used as a synonym for nibbana. Next, he takes up the word anidarsana and makes the following comment. Tadetam nidarsana abhavato anidarsana, that nibbana is called anidarsana because no illustration for it could be given. The idea is that it has nothing to compare with. Then comes the explanation of the word anantam. According to the commentator, nibbana is called ananta, endless, because it has neither the arising end, upadanta, nor the falling end, vayanta, nor the otherwiseness of the persisting end, tithas anyatha. Strangely enough, even the last mentioned middle state is counted as an end. In the commentator's concept of three ends. So this is the substance of his commentary to the first three words, vijnanam, anidarsanam, anantam. The commentarial interpretation of the term sabbato pabham is even more confusing. The word pabha is explained as a synonym for papa, meaning fault. The bha element in the word, he explains, is a result of consonantal interchange with the original pa in papa. Pakarasya pana bhakaro kato. The idea is that the original form of this particular term for nibbana is sabbato papam. The meaning attributed to it is it fords on all sides. Nibbana is supposed to be metaphorically conceived as the ocean to get down into which there are fords on all sides, namely the 38 topics of meditation. This interpretation seems rather far-fetched. It is as if the commentator has resorted to this simile of a ford because he is already in deep waters. The word Pabha, as it is, clearly means light or radiance, and its association with wisdom is also well attested in the canon. Though in his commentary to the Digha Nikaya, Venerable Buddhaghosa advances the above interpretation, in his commentary to the Majjhima Nikaya, he seems to have had second thoughts on the problem. In the Brahmanimantanika Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, also the first two lines of the verse, Vijnanam Anidassanam Anantam Sabbato Pabham, occur. But here the commentator follows a different line of interpretation. Whereas in his commentary to Kevada Sutta, he explains Anidassanam as an epithet of Nibbana in the sense of having nothing to compare with, here he takes it in the sense of not being visible to the eye. Chakhu vinyanasa apatham anupagamanato anidassanam nama. It is called anidassana because it does not come within the range of eye consciousness. In explaining the term sabbato pabham, he suggests several alternative interpretations. In the first interpretation, he takes pabha to mean light or luster. Sabbato pabhanti sabbato pabha sampannam nibbanato hi anyadhammo sappabhataroa Jyotimattarova, Parisuddhatarova, Pandaratarova, Natthi. Sabbato Pabham means more lustrous than anything else, for there is nothing more lustrous or luminous or purer or whiter than Nibbana. In this interpretation, Nibbana is even regarded as something white in color. The etymology of the term Sabbato Pabham has been given a twist, for the word Sabbato is taken in a comparative sense, that is, more lustrous than anything. As we have pointed out, the term actually means lustrous on all sides. Then a second interpretation is given, bringing in the word Pabhu, Lord or Chief, Sabbatova Pabhu, that is to say, more prominent than anything else. In support of it, he says, Asuka disaya nama nibbanam nathiti namattabbam. It should not be said that in such and such a direction Nibbana is not to be found. He says that it is called Pabhu or Lord because it is to be found in all directions. Only as the third interpretation, he cites his simile of the Ford already given in his commentary to Kevada Sutta. What is the reason for giving so many figurative interpretations as alternatives to such a significant verse? Surely the Buddha would not have intended the verse to convey so many conflicting meanings when he preached it. No doubt the commentators had made a great effort to preserve the Dhamma, but due to some unfortunate historical circumstances, most of the deep discourses dealing with the subject of Nibbana have been handed down without even a clue to the correct version among variant readings. This has left the commentators nonplussed, so much so that they had to give us several vague alternative interpretations to choose from. It is up to us to decide whether we should accept this position as it is or try to improve on it by exploring any other possible means of explanation. We had occasion to mention in our very first sermon that the Buddha himself has prophesied that those discourses which deal with voidness would in time to come go into disuse with their deeper meanings obscured. The interpretations just quoted go to show that already the prediction has come true to a great extent. The phrase we quoted from the Brahmanimantanika Sutta with its reference to Anidassana Vijnana occurs in a context which has a significance of its own. The relevant paragraph therefore deserves our attention. It runs as follows. Vijnanam Anidassanam Anantam Sabbato Pabham Tam Pathaviya Pathavittena Nanubhutam Apasa Apattena Nanubhutam Tejasa Tejattena Nanubhutam Vayasa Vayattena Nanubhutam Bhutanang Bhutattena Ananubhutam, Devanang Devattena Ananubhutam, Pajapatissa Pajapatitthena Ananubhutam, Brahmanang Brahmattena Ananubhutam, Abhasaranang Abhasarattena Ananubhutam, Vehapharanang Vehapharattena Ananubhutam, Abhibhusa Abhibhuttena Ananubhutam, Sabbasa Sabbattena Ananubhutam. Consciousness which makes nothing manifest, infinite and all lustrous, it does not partake of the earthiness of earth, the wateriness of water, the fieriness of fire, the airiness of air, the creaturehood of creatures, the devahood of devas, the pajapatihood of pajapati, the brahmahood of brahma, the radiance of the radiant ones, the vehaphalahood of the vehaphala brahmas, the overlordship of the overlord, and the allness of the all. This peculiar paragraph, listing 13 concepts, seems to convey something deep about the nature of the non-manifestative consciousness. That consciousness does not partake of the earthiness of earth, the wateriness of water, the fieriness of fire, and the airiness of air. That is to say, the nature of the four elements does not inhere in this consciousness. They do not manifest themselves in it. Similarly, the other concepts like devahood, brahmahood, etc., which the worldlings take seriously as real, have no applicability or validity here. The special significance of this assertion lies in the context in which the Buddha declared it. It is to dispel a wrong view that Bhaka the Brahma conceived in regarding his Brahma status as permanent, everlasting and eternal that the Buddha made this declaration before that Brahma himself in the Brahma world. The whole point of the discourse then is to challenge the wrong view of the Brahma by asserting that the non-manifestative consciousness of the Arahant is above the worldly concepts of elements and divinity and the questionable reality attributed to them. In other words, they do not manifest themselves in it. They are transcended.
Dear listeners, it is our sincere wish to make these sermons accessible free of charge to all who like to listen to them, because the gift of the Dhamma excels all other gifts. We therefore encourage you to copy these sermons and share them with others, but kindly note that they should not be reproduced for sale. May the blessings of the Triple Gem be with you.